The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
So, lovely winter day, gray sky and tiniest snowflakes coming down. Here in the dark time of the year, our gathering together, always a surprise to me to find myself here, and I feel such gratitude to all of you. Who would also come here, who would also set out on this path of liberation. Sometimes it seems so impossible. No handholds, no footholds, lost in the dark weeds. I keep looking for myself. Together we do this, the wonderful, wonderful Sangha, coming together with good friends, new friends and old friends, some of us getting quite old now, many years, many winters. Or maybe a first day, or just listening in. It makes no difference because the way is endless, and the way only leads here. When we think of the way, we might imagine that there's some path leading forward, and we have to find this path, and that it goes somewhere else. But the big secret is that there is no path. There is nothing further that needs to be done. This is it. And as we look into these Lojong teachings, and today, I hope to talk about number 9 in the slogans. 9 out of 59, we better start hurrying or we won't get it all accomplished. Number 9, Norman Fisher's translation is turn things around. We read a short excerpt from Katagiri Roshi's Returning to Silence. Katagiri Roshi was a Japanese Zen master who started the Zen Center in Minneapolis, lived and taught and wrote there for many years. His book, Returning to Silence, is one that I go back to again and again. His clarity and his great joy comes through. And one of our Dharma cousins is one of his Dharma heirs. Anyway, we read an excerpt, and he says in the excerpt, sometimes we should indeed reflect on these things, but when these questions make our head ache, we should just forget thinking. As we look into these Lojong teachings and the absolute this and the relative that and bodhicitta, sometimes my head aches and my eyes cross and I feel I will never understand, just more and more lost, and I try to explain and it just gets worse. Katagiri Roshi so kindly, as he is expounding the Dharma, as he is expounding these beautiful teachings, these teachings of the Buddha that the Buddha said are medicine, we take our medicine, the medicine of good views, of right views of the truth. But sometimes we try to understand and it just doesn't work. And so he suggests when we get to this place of confusion, of can't hold it together, that we should forget thinking, just practice. In the Buddha's world, there is no end. Forget about the end and take one step like an elephant or a turtle. So important as we do this study or as we encounter any of these wonderful teachings, that we remember that there is no end, there is no destination other than this moment. And that the first slogan is train in the preliminaries. So the preliminaries are one, these remembrances of the preciousness of human life, of the absolute inevitability of death, of the power of our actions and of the unavoidability of suffering. So we remember these to inspire us. But the preliminaries are also our zazen, our practice of waking up right here, our practice of being with the breath, of sitting in open awareness, of counting the breath, whatever it is. This is the preliminary, and there is nothing other than the preliminary. We don't graduate to be something other than we are. And in fact, at graduation, we hand out a certificate and we say, you are you. You have always been you. Congratulations. This is the end of the journey. To come to where we have always been, and as T.S. Eliot says, to know it as if for the first time. We wander around looking for our home, like with a flashlight in a dark room, looking for the flashlight, shining the beam everywhere. Where could it be? Where could it be? Maybe over in the corner, under the couch, maybe in the scary closet. I will find that flashlight somewhere. I will know the truth. I will find liberation. I will wake up. Meanwhile, all the time, this effortless functioning of the Dharma. You have never taken a step away. Every step is the destination. And so to forget about the end, there is no end, take one step, and we are all elephants and turtles, these wonderful beings, just one step. Now, actually, I hear that turtles can actually scurry pretty quickly, seems so slow, but at times... and elephants so ponderous, but can actually move quite quickly. But just one step, just one breath. We don't have to know anything. We don't have to figure out. We cannot figure out. And then he says, and to me this is the light of Katagiri Roshi shining on all of us. This is our practice, this taking one step. It is wonderful and beautiful. In this way, let us practice for 3,000 kalpas. Right here, this practice, this upright, dignified posture, this returning again and again, this failing again and again, this is the great joy, the great life of all worlds. And that we can find this, we can find our way into this. just by taking our next step, by being ourself, always no choice, always already happening, and yet a reminder to appreciate the wonder and beauty, as Dogen said, practice is awakening. And awakening is practice. We don't practice in order to awaken. In fact, if you hadn't had some taste of awakening, if you weren't had some glimmer, you would not practice. So maybe more accurate to say we wake up, something wakes us up, a hit over the head, something wonderful, something terrible, and then we practice. But in this sense of the absolute compassion, this absolute, this bigger perspective, there is no difference. Practice is the whole thing. This is wonderful and, of course, challenging. And so, challenging ourselves with these slogans, with this medicine, and the latest dose of medicine here, number 9, to turn things around. And I think, in some ways, this is the heart of our practice and the clear directions of these Lojong teachings. We talk about training in compassion. And this training in compassion is about opening the possibility for meeting our life in some new way. This is about the possibility of transformation. And this transformation is not what you can do. It is not that if I get good enough at this, I will be able to transform. You are not that powerful. I am not that powerful. But the teaching that how we meet our life is our life. The other reading we did in our sutra service is from Joan Tollefson's book, Painting the Sidewalk with Water. This wonderful analogy of the weather, this internal weather. She says, of course, when the weather comes outside, we don't, no one is responsible for this. Sometimes it snows, sometimes it's cold, sometimes it's warm, sometimes not so. And that what arises in our mind and body, is we might think of it as this same way. That sometimes you look at your life and you are overwhelmed. The forces of life are arrayed against you. Nothing is working out. Things are difficult and there's no end in sight. And then with the exact same life, maybe half an hour later or a moment later, suddenly no problem. Just life, and you appreciate the taste of the food. Appreciate sitting in the silence. Certainly we can verify, those of us who sit on the cushion, or perhaps every human being, that it keeps changing. The Buddha's teaching of impermanence is quite evident when we pay attention. And we don't know why it keeps changing. Why in one moment am I so discouraged and disheartened, and in another moment, quite bright and cheerful. But this is the weather that comes. And there are some mind trainings that focus on trying to control the weather. Many self-help books will tell you if you think the right thoughts or eat the right food, do the right thing, that you will be fine. And of course, there is great power in our thoughts and in our actions and habits, but ultimately, you will lose. Ultimately, you cannot control your life. We chant every sutra service the five remembrances. Each one of us will get sick. Each one of us, if we're lucky, will get old. Of course, some of us already lucky. Old age already here. Oh my goodness. And all of us will die. These preliminary reminders are the foundation of life. So how do we live in a world where we don't get what we want? And this is where this slogan of turn things around encourages a fundamental shift from the modality of fixing or running away to, as Norman Fisher says, to make use of pain and confusion in your life instead of trying to get rid of it. This possibility of making use of our pain and confusion rather than trying to get rid of it. If our pain and confusion is a resource, if it is workable, then we are in luck. Because inexhaustible source for us human beings of difficulty. This was one of Buddha's other observations on life, along with impermanence, is that difficulty is unavoidable. This was also his so-called first noble truth. His teaching is not that this is the problem with being human, is that we have problems, but this is the first noble, the first wonderful, the first great truth of human life, the great truth of difficulty, of suffering, of discomfort. This is not the problem to be overcome, but this is the entry point. So turn things around is Norman Fisher's wonderful summation of the slogan that's actually three objects, three poisons, three seeds of virtue in the original. So just to say a little bit about these ancient teachings, three objects, three poisons, three seeds of virtue. The three objects refer not to physical objects, but to the observation that whatever arises in our field of awareness, we have three different reactions to it. There are some things that are attractive to us, smell of soup in the kitchen. Being on Sesshin is a little bit like being camping. Like, the food is so great. You know how you go camping? Well, and I go camping. And the stuff that I would never touch when I'm at home, suddenly, even Tang can seem wonderful if you're on a camping trip. I've tried drinking it at home, and I go, oh my goodness. But out in the woods, and we are out in the woods appreciating our food so lovingly prepared by our Tenzo. But anyway, there is attractive. Something arises, a thought, and it's attractive. Or there's some pushing away, unattractive. I don't like this. I don't like this sensation in my knees. I don't like this confusion in my mind. And then there's some things that are neutral. So this teaching of the three objects is actually also the teaching of the second foundation of mindfulness. In the Buddhist teaching around mindfulness, around remembering, the first foundation is awareness of breath and body. So we notice the body, sensations in the body, and we notice the breath. And this is the beginning place. But then as we pay attention more, we can begin to notice these three feeling tones, we sometimes say, but these three immediate reactions that human beings have to, could be a sound, maybe the sound of a bird. You hear it and you think, oh, that sweet bird. Maybe it's the person gunning their motorcycle on Pleasant Street, and we're trying to have a good retreat here. And why do people do that? Why are they so inconsiderate? That's the aversion, the unattractive. And then lots of noises happen that we don't, you know, not one thing or the other. So you can notice these three different feeling tones arising. This is not good or bad. It just seems to be the way that human beings are, naturally, not a problem. And then we go to the three poisons. One of us was asking this question a few days ago. The three poisons are greed, anger, and ignorance. And this teaching is that these three poisons in some way naturally occur in response to the three objects, these three feeling tones. When something is attractive, we tend to want more of it. Another bite. Or, oh, I hope the bird goes on singing. Or, I want to remain in this mind state. Finally, I've come to spaciousness, and I just want to stay here. So the greediness is a wanting more, trying to pull it towards us. And from the unattractive feeling tone, there is this pushing away, this anger, this aversion. I want less of this. I don't like that sound. I don't like this sensation. And so we try to push it away. There's a kind of aggression in that. And then ignorance, oftentimes when it's neither attractive nor unattractive, it slides into a kind of dullness. This ignorance of the three poisons, quite different from not knowing. Ignorance more like a foggy whatever, I don't even care. This ignorance can also appear sometimes, as we say, delusive certainty. I know I'm right, I don't need to hear anything or know anything else because it is so clear to me. This is a form of ignorance. So these three poisons arise. And as we begin to practice and pay attention, we can see more clearly greed, anger, and ignorance arising. And I think it's quite natural as these arise to want to get rid of them. So we think, well, if I train hard enough, if I meditate enough, if I have a deep enough insight, I will no longer get angry, or I will no longer be lost in resentment, wishing I had what that person had. But this is quite impossible. And the encouragement in turning things around is that rather than trying to get rid of the feeling of greed or the wanting more that is arising, rather than trying to fix the problem. So when dullness arises, you're sitting and it's late in the day and you're foggy and you can't remember why you thought it was a good idea to sign up for this training period. It seemed like it would be fun. I'd have a Zen experience. And here I am just with my aching body and my mind going round and round. So when this state arises or any other state, this turn things around is the invitation to stay with it, rather than trying to fix. As Joan Tolleson said, in this moment, is there definitely a problem that needs to be solved? Or is there only ever-changing appearance, endlessly solving and dissolving itself? Is there really someone who needs to figure out what to do about it and fix it? So we practice, and here's where I think these slogans can be so useful in our Zen practice. It is just an encouragement to turn toward what is arising. When something arises and there is aversion, for me, of course, on these retreats, I go through my many changes, and for me last night, I was quite confused and discouraged, disheartened. I always go through a period of being quite certain that I'm just still the same old idiot I've always been. And it's quite a hopeless task for me. And I was conscious of a kind of familiar internal dialogue, and a familiar feeling that I don't like at all. I don't like it when I'm confused and discouraged. And then I remembered, turn it around. It just came to me. I knew I was going to have to say something today. Turn it around. And just a hair's breadth difference. And I thought, what if this isn't a problem? Now, usually when it appears, it's so clear it's a problem that I don't even have to call it a problem. I shouldn't feel like this after these decades. I should always be confident and strong and clear. So I'm off to fix it or to practice harder or do something. But this possibility of not doing something, when the urge comes to turn away or the urge comes to fix, we can notice those urges and turn it around. And when we turn it around, of course, turn it, turn yourself, turn myself around, to just meet. What if it's not a problem? What if this is how human beings sometimes feel? What if this is part of the endless solving and dissolving, this arising and passing away? And I don't need to come up with a great solution, and that maybe, as Joan Tolleson says, it's not even so personal. This great arising of reactivity, or this subtle arising of reactivity, is not a problem, and that I don't have to do anything. So coming. Back here to our ancestor Linji's wonderful teaching, do nothing. Do nothing. And when we turn in this way, again, Norman Fisher says, our messes and our problems become our treasures. Our messes and our problems become our treasures. So the point is not about being less messy or being quite clever in solving your problems, but about hanging around long enough to allow the transformation to occur. Our job, your job, my job is to pay attention, to practice this compassion that is just being with. So when lost and confused, you can know what it's like to be lost and confused. To know what it's like in this moment, not what it was like yesterday or last year. And when we turn in this way, when we are present with our life, then these three poisons, these three problems, the great reactivity, is simply the energy of life. And they become the three seeds of virtue. These problems, all of themselves, not through any trickery or any great skill on your part or my part, they transform. We see into the true nature that is just energy arising. This astonishing and weird and crazy and mysterious and awesome energy of life, and our miserable karma becomes our wonderful dharma, and we find ourselves blessed with resource. Everything that arises becomes the Buddha himself becomes liberation just in this moment. So this invitation, as you notice yourself pushing away, trying to fix, trying to go somewhere else, the invitation to turn things around, to turn around and be with and see what happens for you. Thank you. So please sit comfortably. We'll move into our Dharma dialogue, and a reminder that we do record these talks, and if you'd rather ask your question or say something off the record, we can turn this off at any time. So let's say our names. I'm David.
Melissa.
Candace.
Jenny.
Ray. Craig.
So, questions about the talk, about this point, about practice? Yeah, observations, right?
More observation. And this is my own process. We talk about compassion. Training in compassion, for me that's, and it's a sheen, it's a heart movement, you know, rather than an activity of the mind. Mm. And the heart is an action organ, you know. But whenever I hear mind training, it's just, I get lost. I start thinking some concepts, some understanding, something that I need to learn or understand. Mm-hmm. And that's, so for me, that I guess I'm realizing from your talk that I need to take it into my heart.
Yeah.
You know, and not leave it out there.
Yeah. Let me just say, I just think that's so important, and often the translation in the Chinese or Indian, the word for mind is the heart mind.
Right.
And we here think of mind as such a particular thing. I think we can't be reminded enough that, yeah, this is the heart training.
Yeah, I need to be reminded.
Yeah. Me too. Yeah.
The other piece too, just this is going back to the tonglen training. You know, it's for me when I breathe in, I bring it to my heart, right? Mm-hmm. And the heart, that's where the activity of the small relative heart becomes the heart of the world. Mm-hmm. Not separate. If I keep it small, then it's just me giving a message. But when the heart becomes huge on the out breath, it does whatever it does, and mm-hmm. I'm not involved with it. It's mm-hmm. the heart of the world responding mm-hmm. right. to what mm-hmm. I've experienced. The brain breathing in.
Yeah,
exactly. And I might even say that the heart doesn't become larger; it recognizes its largeness. You know, that there's some consciousness, right? Because it's huge. It's not my little heart, right? And this translation issue is really important, because remember the people who translated this into English from Tibetan and Sanskrit and Chinese and Japanese and Korean were 19th century male scholars in Europe who really were favoring the mind over the heart. There was no concept of that you're speaking so eloquently about. And more in the 21st century, Buddhist teachers are starting to say heart-mind a lot more. There's more translations that include the heart. And it's just so important to keep doing that translation for ourselves. And it's weird, too, because heart in the West has at least in English, has a funny connotation, too. You know, but I know what you mean. I mean, I think I do, anyway. I think I do, right? There I go. There's such a bias in all of us. All of us have been to school, right? We were trained, don't pay attention to your feelings. Think this through. You know, sit there for a moment. Think about what you did. But it's very, very biased. So to remember that it's a whole body thing. Mm-hmm. And it's not even just the heart. You know, the heart kind of suffuses the body. Yeah. Right? And turns on with each breath. And it's just such an amazing recollection, which is what mindfulness even, terrible translation. Right? It's this re-embodying.
Yeah. And Alan, what were you saying the other day about the belly and the intelligence of that they're more...
Oh, yeah. So this goes way back to my months at the San Francisco Zen Center, when I was 18, starting out on this path. And
that's in 1842?
Yeah.
You were one of those 19th century male songs.
And in San Francisco Zen Center, they use the Japanese word hara a lot. Mm-hmm. And there, in fact, there's a funny little piece by the guy Brad...
Warner?
Brad Warner, that says, I left my hara in San Francisco. but the hara describes that area, you know, around the solar plexus that also has lots of neural ganglia meeting. And neuroscientists got really interested in it because they found out that it had more neurons than a dog's brain. So, and dogs are pretty smart. So a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah.
And this is the center of our body.
Right. And not the solar plexus, but the navel.
Yeah, but below the solar plexus.
Yeah, yeah. Below the navel, yeah.
And kind of around it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so there's, you know, this possibility of dropping your awareness.
Yeah.
So that, and you know, all this gets into technique, but it's also just acknowledging what's there.
Right.
But because we're visual creatures and our eyes, our visual system takes up a huge amount of our neocortex of the modern part of the modern human part of the brain, we tend to keep our awareness up here, mm-hmm. and it unbalances us.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So dropping it down.
Yeah. Yeah.
And just to add that there's a lot of neural activity in the heart,
right.
as well. That's the mm-hmm. since you were at the San Francisco Zen Center, so this research has continued, and so so we sometimes talk about three brains in the body: the gut brain, the heart brain, and the
brain. and it's important to remember that because of that very thing you're talking about.
But there's a funny anecdote that goes with that that I was told back then, which was a Japanese teacher was visiting, and some of the senior people were talking, and at one point he said, "And I feel it in my heart."
And he put his
hand down his belly. I feel it in my heart.
I feel it in my heart. And there's a similar story about one of the neurologists who's been researching mindfulness and really interested in Tibetan practices because he's a Tibetan practitioner, and went to Nepal, where, you know, many Tibetan people have fled, and was doing research on the brain and wanted to find out what happens in compassion, and wired up all these people with all these electrodes, and it was very exciting. And the Tibetan monks who were getting wired up were just laughing. They couldn't stop laughing. And they finally said, finally the researcher, Richie Davidson, said, "Why are you finding this so amusing?" He said, "Because you think the brain is up here, and you should be wiring our hearts." so that it's really, and this is one of the things I love about Buddhism. Buddhism is not based on somebody's idea about the way things are. Buddhist teachings are based on actual experience of being alone, upright, unmoving with the body mind, with the heart mind for long periods of time and learning things. You know, so this is and then it's wonderful when it's affirmed by science, in my opinion.
Yeah. Well, first I just want to say you gave me some really helpful feedback earlier. So you need to feel good about that.
Okay. All right. Wow. Wow, that's great.
And then you mentioned briefly about power. And in one of our chants for the midday, it talks about may our power now, our bodhisattva power extends over the three pair. I still need to look at it. But
yeah.
And then you said, I don't know, I guess if you want to have more input on that word or what that means, bodhisattva power.
Yeah. So it reminds me there's a teaching called the paramitas, which are the qualities of practice, we might say. Paramita means to cross over, and it's generosity and discipline and other things, and there are different lists of them, but on some list bala is included, and bala is power. So as we are practicing, we are cultivating power, that there is an energetic thing that we are doing to be ourselves. So even sitting in our zazen, there are so many, of course, practice is so many things. Sometimes it's just receiving, sitting upright in the middle. And sometimes it is manifesting your life and your love. And it takes power to meet the world, because there will be strong energy that comes at you from all kinds of ways. So there is a power and energy being able to access that to help you respond appropriately. It's not like a power over, you're going to be stronger and make everything do, but it's a power to touch what is true and to stand in what is true, whatever is happening. And that's what that's what we're doing here, right? Sit in our power, whatever is happening, good day, bad day. The mind is, of course, the real problem is all the people who live in our mind. So it takes power not to run away. Oftentimes on retreat, new people will often say, "Well, so and so drove me, and I'm glad that he drove me, because if I had keys, I would have gone out to the car and left." And we all know that feeling. So that's the feeling of power, power as connection to this truth that is so precious. Is that?
Yeah, that gets it. Yeah,
great.
Thank you.
Yeah. Just to add, and actually to weave it back into something Ray said, you know, that there's, the heart is actually an action organ. So one of my comments on what Ray said, the power is, this bodhisattva power, it's not your individual personal power. It's the power of the wisdom beings that fill the universe manifest themselves as you in particular. And also, it's not just you in particular.
Yeah.
And that's really important that we don't own it. I remember talking with a friend years ago and really upset about something and saying, oh, I'm just a very poor excuse for a bodhisattva. I'm just, you know, falling down on the job. And she said, well, who is the bodhisattva? And I said, well, I'm not the bodhisattva. And then I suddenly said, oh, I'm not the bodhisattva. We both started laughing because it was like, right. This flowing through. I think we become more permeable as we practice. And all these energies, bodhicitta is sometimes translated as wisdom energy. You know, the heart mind is an energetic force. It just flows through us. And we get to use it.
Yeah.
In our heart activity, in our belly activity.
Yeah. Well, so on that note, let's use our energy to be ourselves.